Okay, hi everyone. Thanks for coming. As I've made very clear several in all the emails, I don't really know what this is going to be. I've been talking to people about doing something like this for years, and I kept putting it off because I couldn't work out what the format should be, and then eventually I just realised I wasn't going to be able to figure that out until we did it. So we're doing it anyway. What we're not going to do, what I never really do, whether I'm teaching or sort of facilitating in other kind of contexts, is just do like a set piece lecture and then have a chat about it afterwards. And I mean, how much of this is me talking at you about stuff you might want me to talk at you about is going to be up to you, and how much of it's an open discussion will be up to you. So I'll probably start talking about something and then you just interrupt me. As you want to. Does that work?
Yep.
All right.
Do you need to get hooked up?
No, I don't. No, I'm not going to use it. Okay. I'm going to use it sparingly, I think. Okay. Rather. The theme of the session, broadly speaking, is neoliberal common sense. But really, that's a way into looking at, in some sort of detail, the Gramscian understanding of hegemony, what that means, where that comes from, and what some of its political consequences might be. I'll say a little bit more just about the kind of general idea here, if I can get the notes I made this morning up. This set of discussions really going on over several years around the kind of mutual education work that we might need to build or rebuild some kind of a popular left movement. The first thing I'll say about today, and it's germane to the topics we're going to be talking about, is this is an experiment and not a product. So if you find yourself sitting there thinking, "Oh, this is annoying, this is a waste of my time," then don't. I mean, don't think like that. Speak up, talk about something, change the direction of the conversation, and keep in mind that I don't really know the best way to do this any better than anybody. It's very easy to get into that kind of sort of quite passive, consuming mentality. I'm going to say something, I'll just say something momentarily about, what I see as being the value of this kind of work that we're going to be looking at today, the value of sort of theory broadly. I mean, it's worth keeping in mind that this isn't something I would have to say in most countries. It's something quite specific about the context, not just of the English left, but of English political culture generally, that you have to make some sort of apology or explanation for why you might want to spend some time talking about concepts and not just about details and facts and hard facts. But broadly speaking, I think the first thing to say about studying theory in any way is that everyone is a theorist. I mean, Gramsci famously says everyone is a philosopher, which is to say everybody has a set of preconceptions about how the world works. And if you don't interrogate them, then you just don't know. It just means you don't know what they are. So I always say everyone is a theorist. It's just people who think they're not theorists just don't know even what their own theories are. So part of the purpose of this is to try to create a context in which we can sort of think about those issues. On the other hand, the purpose of theory in the social sciences, in politics, in political activism and action is the same as theory in the physical sciences, really. It's the point at which you try and extrapolate some general conclusions from various kind of historical experiences, which then might be useful in later in other contexts. Does that make sense? And I think that is its value. And that is its purpose. And so there's a difference between theory and just, say, philosophical speculation. Philosophical speculation is just, this is what I reckon based on nothing apart from that's what I reckon to some extent. Whereas theory is ideally grounded in a set of experiences and is the place at which we try and reflect on experiences and kind of derive some conclusions from them which might be relevant in other contexts. I'm going to say something momentarily just about the difference between the context in which I'm used to doing this stuff and this context that we're trying to create here. I mean, I'm used to doing this stuff in an academic context. I'm used to teaching this stuff to third year undergraduates and MA students. And the difference is they've got to come out with something that looks like a formal qualification. So they've got to come out knowing what all this jargon means and being able to reproduce it in an acceptable format to an external examiner so they can take that qualification into the labour market. Does that make sense? That's what I'm used to doing, And I think inevitably I'm liable to fall into that mode when doing that here, wanting to make sure everybody, you know, gets this stuff and can answer an exam question about it at the end of it, which isn't really what we're here for. We're here because we think this is stuff that might be useful politically, analytically, and actively. So, but all I can do really is signal the fact that after 20 years of doing that and being quite good at it, I'm liable to fall into that as a kind of habit, and forgive me if I do, and we'll try to get out of it. This is for all of us. I mean, this is sort of all of us's space, I hope. But on the other hand, I will if I take any kind of role here at all, it will be to, well, I am clearly going to take quite a didactic role in practice. it will be to try to keep us on topic. I had several emails from people about things they want to talk about. Several people saying, to be honest, I don't want to talk about what we're going to talk about today. I want to talk about something completely different. Actually, what the general thrust is that what people want to talk about is action, is strategy. How do we get out of neoliberal hegemony? We all want to talk about that. Partly, we've designed this as a sort of series, and we're going to talk about that in much more detail much later. I would say we are going to talk about that. There's no point being here if we don't. But one of the reasons for constituting this space is a general feeling amongst the people who were first talking about doing it, that there is often a tendency, at least on the British left, the kind of activist left, to want to rush into those kind of conclusions, to assume that, oh, we all know what the problem is, let's just figure out what to do about it now. And one of the premises I'm starting from here is that, we all know roughly what the problems are, but they might at times be more complicated than it initially appears. It might require some careful thought in order to develop effective political strategies. So that's why I think we have to have... I'm not going to jump into that. Okay, so we'll move on to the sort of general content. So there's two. obviously not everyone would have looked at it, but I also know some people have. The thing I suggested as the kind of basic reading for today is this essay on neoliberal common sense, and we're very lucky that we've got one. The author of it, or the co-author with Stuart Allen, is right there. He's also the person who taught me this. He was one of the people who taught me this stuff sort of 20 years ago. So,
if he's got it wrong, you know it.
Yeah. And also, I know that there are a number of people here who are as expert on these issues as I am. So anytime I'm getting anything wrong, just sort of shout it out. But I think broadly speaking, though, what we're going to aim to do over the next sort of hour or so is get to a situation where people who don't feel sort of confident with that, by the end of it, can feel fairly confident that they have a sense of what these kind of key terms that have got thrown around bits of the left and the kind of academic left over the past 50, 20, 30, 40 years mean, what we mean by these terms like hegemony, common sense, and what their kind of political implications are. Does that make sense? All right. So... We will talk about neoliberalism, about what is meant by it. We'll talk about common sense. But what I wanted to start with is some background about the idea of hegemony and what the kind of nuances are in thinking about that, its genesis and its kind of application. Does that sound okay, or does that sound boring? All right, fine. All right. So now, mainly I'm talking about the tradition which goes back to the work of Antonio Gramsci here, the Italian communist leader and thinker who wrote his most important work while in prison in the 1930s. I'll show you a picture of him in a minute. and within that, I should stress I'm talking about the English Gramsci. There's a particular version of Gramsci, which is Gramsci has translated into English and collected in the early 70s, which has become a key reference point now for several generations of left thinkers and analysts on the British left, particularly in the 1980s. Neil Kinnock, famously the leader of the Labour Party, then famously said Gramsci was the most important influence on his thinking. Both architects and critics of New Labour claimed Gramsci and his theory of hegemony as a key reference point. So it's not the kind of Italian Gramsci who you would find if you go and read it all really thoroughly in Italian that we're talking about. Now, if you're interested in that, the book to read is a book called The Gramscian Moment by a guy called Peter Thomas, who is based at Brunel. He's an Australian guy. I invited him to come down. He couldn't. He sends his wishes, though. his good wishes. Okay, with all those provisos, hegemony. Okay, so people, this is a term we've heard before, right? Hegemony. Okay, does anyone want to suggest to me a meaning for hegemony? Briefly, quickly.
Everybody thinks the same way.
It's not necessarily, but that is part of it, right? That is definitely part of it, is getting people to think the same way.
It's kind of if a dominant idea becomes so naturalised and kind of widely accepted that it looks as though there's no alternative.
All right, well, let's make a... What you two are both talking about is actually common sense, really. What you're both describing is common, the situation of common sense. Now, the situation of common sense is related to hegemony. It's not exactly the same thing, though. Okay, what I'm going to say, hegemony. Hegemony in English is actually a translation of several different words in the Italian, as I understand. I don't read Italian. But the one which is most normally translated is the Italian word hegemonia. And hegemonia would normally be translated into English as leadership. And I think this is really a key thing to understand. What you'll often find, or in places like Wikipedia, you'll find in sort of undergraduate texts, you'll find the statement being made that hegemony refers to some form of domination. But sometimes that's right, and sometimes Gramsci even uses that kind of language. But it's really useful, I would say, to students as a kind of conceptual exercise. Get rid of any notion of domination out of your mind when talking about hegemony. So that's really not what he's talking about. What he is talking about is leadership. It's the process by which one social group comes to occupy a leading position in relation to others. And it's worth thinking about then, well, what does leadership actually involve? You know, what does it mean to lead? Well, what is it? I mean, broadly speaking, what is it that a leader does? What is the most basic thing that the word to lead refers to?
Acquire a bunch of followers.
Well, you acquire a bunch of followers, but what does it then do with the followers? It gets them to follow, right?
Mm-hmm. In,
well, not necessarily. That's the next thing. But I think it does exercise power, but it exercises power in a really particular way. What it does is to determine the direction of travel. The leader decides which direction you're going in, right? Does that make sense? The leader decides which direction you're going in. Now, there are lots of ways of doing that. You might do that by persuading people to come with you. And you might do it by impressing them enough that they just do, whether they sort of are persuaded or not. And you might do it by intimidating them. And you might do it by coercing them. You might do it by seducing them in some way. You might inspire imitation. You might convince others of your moral authority. You might convince others of your legitimacy. It's not exactly the same thing. You might convince others of your unique competence. I think that's particularly relevant for our situation, because broadly speaking, I think in Britain today, at least in England, I think people basically defer to the social group who they think know how to run things. It's important because they don't really agree with them. They don't even really think they deserve to run things. They think they know how it works, so let them do it. You convince others of your indispensability. I think this is pretty much what you can think about what happened after the banking crash. When the bank, you know, the key social group of finance capitalists, the bankers, pretty much convinced governments that they just couldn't do without them. We cannot do without them. We've got to do everything possible to shore up these people. And that is what hegemony really looks like in practice, I think. You can completely trash the economy and be clearly responsible for it and clearly have broken all the rules and be hated by everyone, and nothing happens to you. You just continue to maintain your privileges, and things continue to be organised largely for your benefit. You can convince others of your invincibility. I mean, this is essentially, again, thinking back to the crash, this is essentially the situation with somebody like Gordon Brown, who just ultimately didn't believe that finance capitalists could be beaten in a political fight, that you just had to defer to it. You can convince others that you're... Now, the classic notion of hegemony, which is the one that Gramsci talks about the most, is that you convince others that your interests and objectives coincide with theirs in some way. That basically your interests are their interests. So what's in the interest of business, for example, is in the interest of everybody. Yeah, that's what's in the interest of Britain. Final two things I've got on my little list. You neutralise opposition or prevent it from emerging. Or you set the terms of debate. Now, those are all things that are involved in the process of establishing leadership. Does that make sense? So when we talk about hegemony, when we talk about a particular group or an idea having hegemony, essentially this is what we mean. We mean that they have established a position, the capacity to determine the general direction of travel of the society or the group according to sort of some combination of those processes. But you can see it can be pretty much any combination of those, which is one of the things that makes it so sort of complicated, but also such a subtle concept. Okay, now I'm going to say a bit about the background here now. Because I think I used to never go on about this when explaining this stuff, but I think it is really useful to understand something about the specificity of the idea. So the term hegemony, I'll show you the pictures. So hegemony, it really comes into the lexicon of Marxist political theory during debates amongst the Russian socialists at the end of the 19th century. So the end of the 19th century, you've got this quite peculiar situation where you have the most developed, the most kind of, arguably one of the most well-organised and one of the most developed kind of radical socialist movements in the world, but you don't have anything like the political conditions for socialism as predicted by Marx. So Marx, and we probably all know this, but Marx assumes that the way in which socialism will come about is that the industrial proletariat will grow and grow until it includes, you know, the vast majority of the population, and will then be able to take state power, you know, possibly in a violent conflict, possibly not requiring one, possibly just through some sort of parliamentary means. But that's the means by which it'll happen. And the thing about Russia is you don't hardly have an industrial proletariat. You do have a communist movement, which is based in amongst urban intellectuals, but you don't have an industrial proletariat, which is nearly big enough to be able to organise a revolution. So what they start to talk about is the idea that, well, possibly the industrial proletariat, which in line with Marxist theory has to be assumed to be the most politically advanced class, might just be the leading group of a sort of social coalition. And this really develops into the basis for Lenin's understanding of revolutionary strategy. So the hammer and the sickle, the famous universal symbol of Leninist communism, is precisely a symbol representing a kind of alliance between different classes. The hammer representing the industrial proletariat, the sickle representing the peasantry. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
So the idea is the proletariat will be the leaders of this coalition, even though the mass of it will be the peasants, and that they in turn, in fact, will be led by the Communist Party and its cadre of elite intellectuals. So what's happening here in the evolution of Marxist theory is you're moving from the idea that revolution will be essentially one social class kind of expressing its historic destiny and taking over the world, to the idea that you'll have multiple social groups in kind of quite complex relationships and coalitions. Does that make sense? And so this is a really sort of crucial shift in what's happening. All right, but it's really Gramsci. It's really Antonio Gramsci who starts to develop this idea. Gramsci, the leader of the Italian Communist Party, under Mussolini, imprisoned by Mussolini. Yeah, that's not fitting on. Famously, the sentencing magistrate says, "We must silence this mind for 1,000 years." They don't manage to silence him in prison. He writes in his notebooks, he writes sort of code, sort of developing his kind of theories about the development of the development of radical and democratic politics. And the reason, I think really the reason Gramsci still seems relevant today is that he was writing about Italy in the 20s and 30s, and the novel features of Italian society, the relatively modern features of Italian society that he's writing about, are ones which really still speak to our condition today in some ways. He was asking about the question of how you do politics, how you do political struggle from a radical perspective or a conservative perspective in a society where you have mass democracy, you have a mass media, you have a complex networks of civil institutions, etc. and what kind of difference that makes. Of course, Gramsci is also face-to-face with, and he's not just face-to-face with, and he's in the aftermath of, the two great crises for Marxism as a theory of politics, or as a model of politics, from which in some ways, arguably, it's been conceptually trying to recover ever since. You know, Marx had predicted that the industrial proletariat would grow. Towards the end of his life, he'd so given up on the American and British working classes, he'd started to think maybe the Russian peasantry could be revolutionary after all. But for most of his career, he thought they would grow, they would become the agents of socialism. And Marx and many people on the left, much like people on the right, largely assumed that with the dawn of universal suffrage, socialism or communism would be inevitable. International socialist movement, especially its more Marxian sections, had largely assumed that if there was an inter-imperialist war in the early 20th century, then the international proletariat would not follow its bourgeois and aristocratic masters, you know, to certain death on the fields of Europe, and would instead revolt against them. But we know what actually happened. What actually happened is the pull of nationalism and imperialism proved sufficiently strong, but that isn't what happened. There wasn't the hopeful revolution in Germany, and after the war, something even worse happened, which nobody really predicted or expected. Apart, arguably, from some of the most conservative sort of theorists of crowd psychology, the rise of fascism. And Gramsci is in the first. He's in the first country in which fascism became prevalent, and he's one of the first victims of it. So he's really trying to work out, well, what has gone on here. How can we formulate something like a theory of politics under these circumstances? It's under those circumstances that he develops that model. He develops this model according to which the hegemony of particular social groups has to be understood in terms of a sort of combination of both coercive features and this very famous term from Gramsci, consent. The idea that ultimately, under the kind of complex social circumstances he's describing, it's no longer possible for hegemonic groups simply to impose their will on people. That in fact they have to some extent, they have to get people to go along with it, according to sort of one of the mechanisms I've referred to. And this is the kind of key notion of consent. Now, consent is to some extent one of the most sort of ambiguous terms in French. It's one of the most ambiguous notions because. And there's this one bit in the prison notebook, which I'm always kind of obsessing over, where he says, consent may be active or passive. So consent...
English is not my first language, so I read Gramsci in Italian and Spanish. And what is consent exactly in English? It's like you give your passive consent to something, right? Because I wouldn't have translated it with the word consent. It is, we use consensus, rather, that is like a common... agreement between the dominated and the dominators, let's say. It's usually you would use the word consent.
Well, I don't know what word you're translating there.
No, usually the word is consent in English.
Yeah, we haven't yet talked about common sense. So common sense is the translation of the notion of the sensus communis, the kind of shared agenda. So consent means a kind of agreement. So it's, uh-huh. If you go along with it, you agree to it. I mean, the image that's constructed is a sort of image of a negotiation, if you like.
Mm.
But of course, it can be either active or passive. So active consent implies that people more or less enthusiastically go along with it. They more or less enthusiastically buy into the kind of what's on offer. Whereas passive consent implies, well, then that's where it gets much more ambiguous. Because there are many different types of passive. I think it's really weird, and I think it is, and especially, I think this, for me, this especially speaks to our kind of current condition, because if you think about the relationship or the status of the sort of cultural, social status of neoliberalism in a country like Britain, do we all know what I mean by neoliberalism? Right. I'm not getting enthusiastic nods from everyone, so maybe we'll go over that at some point. But, you know, if we take neoliberalism to refer to the general set of assumptions informing most governments' programmes since the 1970s, that privatisation is good because individual competition is good, that the rich are the wealth creators, etc. We all okay with that? It's kind of general description.
Yeah.
It's very unclear that many people, I think, I'd like to know what you think, because I'm really getting sick of the sound of my own voice right now. So do we think, to what extent do we think people in a country like Britain actually go along with that? I mean, to what extent do we think people actually accede to that as a the kind of neoliberal worldview?
Is there not like a generation issue? If you've grown up only with neoliberalism, do you know of another alternative? So
yeah, maybe.
How can you consent to that?
I mean, the generational thing is interesting, isn't it? Because there was this British Social Attitude Survey came out a couple of years ago, which said young people are getting much more right wing, they are getting much more neoliberal. And then there was a load of reinterpretation, and then there was another one the year after said, no, that was just a blip, and actually they're not. So it's a good question. I mean, that's a good question.
But don't people find rationalisations for different aspects of their belief structure, and they're not necessarily consistent either with neoliberalism or not with neoliberalism, but elements are drawn from different places. I don't think people think through a common sense perspective on their lives. They've got elements that they've taken from the press, they've got elements they've taken from friends or family. They've got bits from their own experience, which all feed into a range of different views on different aspects.
Yeah, I think that's really persuasive.
I know we're jumping ahead, but Gramsci famously makes a difference between common sense and good sense. Sorry, do you want me to stop there?
It's fine. Well, rush ahead to that bit?
No, it's
I think
just
you're
like
right.
Just reflecting on what has been said. It's just I remember seeing a kind of list of broadly, left-wing policies and the percentage of people in this country that supported them, and then the next columns were the party's positions on them. So I'm talking about renationalisation of things and tax rises for the rich and just general left-wing policy agenda. And according to this, the support for those policies were kind of between like 2/3 and 80-90%. And whereas obviously the Tory party was no. All the parties generally know, Labour a couple of yeses, Greens actually totally yes. But the point is that I still believe that the good sense, in other words, what Gramsci says, that there's this kind of innate, I think, social sense of fairness and justice, is totally out of kilter with neoliberalism.
I think the point I would make is that it's the middle classes that have forgotten about the peasants and the workers. But actually, we look at peasants and workers with disdain, like, we don't see them as people that we don't connect with them. And actually, the rich will always give a peasant and a worker a job. And I think that's where the race is spoken in this country. Anyway,
doesn't it depend to some extent what you think is packed in what comes along with neoliberalism? People don't think neoliberalism is perceived more clear, or it's why our approach to business. You think, well, that means an economy that works, and all the benefits of consumerism, most people see them, and all these other things, along with some bad things, but you don't ever just say, I accept to neoliberalism as a thing, it's a good thing. You think of it as something that has all these other things that come with it, and maybe aren't going to be there if it's not there.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that's consistent with what you were saying, isn't it? And to some extent consistent with what you were saying, but there's a kind of, people have a kind of tapestry of assumptions that they operate with, that some of which connect with kind of the neoliberal narrative quite specifically, and some of which don't necessarily. And it's part of the political struggle is over which of that complex of ideas actually end up determining how people vote and how people operate and how people actually make those key decisions. I think the thing I'm always struck by is if you look at those kind of opinion surveys, if you ask really basic questions like, are rewards are rewards fairly distributed in society based on how hard you work, for example? In Britain, like in most of Western Europe, people say no. Capitalism produces inequalities that are unfair. If you ask people in the States, for example, you'll get a much bigger group of people who actually believe it, who actually believe that story. And I think to some extent, the nature of consent in that situation is quite different. And I think a lot of people in Britain, basically, they didn't like any of the privatisations. They recognised that the kind of individualisation of society over the past 30 years is quite unwelcome. They recognise a lot of the problems, but they don't really believe there's an alternative. They specifically don't believe, I think you've hit the nail on the head, actually, they specifically don't believe there's an alternative that isn't going to undermine their capacity to consume. I mean, we're sort of jumping ahead a bit here, but my own kind of reading of all this stuff is, broadly speaking, we've been offered a deal since the 70s, which we go along with an awful lot of stuff we clearly don't want, because in return we get cheap holidays and plasma TVs, basically. And this is what that is actually meant when people talk about economic competence. What they mean is, will my capacity to consume be sustained or won't it? That's why people say, actually, I care more about the NHS than anything else. Yeah, I'm not that bothered about immigration. I don't like the Tories, but I'm going to vote for them anyway. Because that's the deal that's been done, in a sense. So that is partly what's meant by consent. I mean, that's really, that. This is kind of what's meant by consent, I think. Well, I don't know what is... We talked about that. All right. So now, this is exactly what we're talking about now, is this notion of common sense. This notion that there's this kind of complex of ideas which become sort of routinized, which we think, which become sort of part of our everyday thinking, which become sort of habitual. There's an issue of translation here. So Peter Thomas thinks that common sense is not a good translation of the Italian phrase, because the Italian phrase, as I understand it, would more directly translate as something like received wisdom, sort of conventional wisdom. It doesn't have that connotation which common sense also has in English, of being something which is just self-evident to any rational person. I mean, my argument with Thomas is that actually that does speak really nicely to something specific about English culture. You think about it, actually, that and that kind of anti-theoretical thing I referred to right at the start, that English people do generally believe that what they think is what any rational person would think, like outside of a cultural context. So in that sense, I think it is quite good. But there's also, as you said, there's also this very important point that common sense always contains elements of good sense. And good sense, as you say, is partly a kind of basic social understanding. But, I mean, Gramsci even suggests there are elements of good sense even in the most reactionary common sense. Even the most reactionary common sense. So, I mean, the ideal example in Britain would be sort of the UKIP voters who think that getting out of the EU will solve our problems. I mean, they're wrong about that, but their intuition that the European Union is basically not an institution set up to serve their interests is completely right. I mean, even the kind of debates around immigration, as we got into all this desperately terrible space with sort of blue Labour over this, but... my own kind of ethical and political position is that there's no borders. Students are always shocked when I say this. They can't believe it. I say, look, we're the fourth, fifth richest country in the world. If we can't look after people, we've got a problem. But it's totally true that mass immigration hasn't happened because some benign force that would be nice if Walthamstow was really cosmopolitan. But that's not why it's happened. It's happened, it has happened to create cheap labour, to lower the price of labour. So there's always this grain of good sense, and it's getting hold of that grain of good sense and sort of speaking to it, which Gramsci thinks is always necessary in any kind of counter-hegemonic struggle, any kind of political struggle. Now, I think this does speak really directly to questions of political strategy from people from any part of the left or the progressive movement, because it's really at this point that Gramsci in theory starts to say, well, if you just tell people they're a bunch of wankers, you're not going to get anywhere with them. If you just tell people why they're wrong, and if you just tell people that everything about their entire worldview is totally wrong, you're just never going to get anywhere with them. And if you don't speak to people in a way which somehow connects with the immediacy of their immediate experience, then you're not going to get anywhere with them. So, I mean, this is the point. This is a really interesting article on the way over here before this afternoon I was reading on my phone Peter Mandelson in the New York Times, and I was kind of shocked because Mandelson was saying, he wrote this yesterday, said, we didn't lose because we were left-wing. He actually argued, but we did not lose the election because the content of the manifesto is too left-wing. He said you could win with a left candidate, but you've got to frame, and he's making this argument, you've got to frame it all right. And he says basically people blame claimants not just for their, people dislike lazy benefit claimants not just because they have their views distorted by ideology and class, but also because they, in some sense, because it's an element of their everyday experience in a way which contact with the rich is not. So I think, now this is where it starts to get much more complicated though, because and starts to get more tricky for radical forces. And this is really something to think about, you know, this time and hopefully in future sessions, that, you know, ideology, if you like, the capacity of those in power, of those with hegemony, to some extent influence people's consciousness is not just about influencing what they think. It's also about actually shaping their experience. It's about shaping their real experiences. And I think this is where you get into a more kind of complicated set of arguments. All right. Should I talk about this? The name of the question. These are my sort of student slides. So I'll say, we can talk a little bit about this, because this is about the reception of... this is about the sort of reception of these ideas on the sort of British left. So arguably, I and Alan and some other people here really come from the sort of tradition of British cultural studies, which Gramsci was really crucial. I suppose most people here won't have heard me say this before, I'm kind of amazed anyone hasn't, because I say this about 10 times a year to somebody. Gets hard hearing myself say this, but one of the things that really helped to put cultural studies on the kind of intellectual map, and one of the things that really elevated Stuart Hall to his status as one of the key left intellectuals of his generation, was the fact that this study they did in the 1970s, which began as a kind of media study of a moral panic around mugging in British newspapers, ended up being the text which more or less predicted the emergence of Thatcherism, which more or less predicted the shape of Thatcherism at a time when, crucially, most people on the British left, and the British right, in fact, in 1978, thought the Tory party had made a terrible mistake in electing this obscure woman from the far right of the party as leader, and that she would be gone quite soon, and normal business would be restored. I think that's a fair assessment, isn't it?
I remember it well.
One of the reasons why Gramsci established the kind of prestige that he did as a source in the 80s in Britain was that he was seen as being the key analytical resource on which Hall and his colleagues had drawn in this study. And this really extraordinary book, Policing the Crisis. It starts off with a really simple observation. It starts off with this observation that there's been a spate of newspaper reports, and I think, what year was it? Was it 74?
78?
Yes. No, 78 is when it was published, the newspaper reports were. 72 to 74. Around the rise of mugging, which is a new term, when in fact, statistically, there hasn't been any measurable rise in violent street crime, and there certainly hasn't been any measurable rise in young black men perpetrating violent street crime against white people, which is what all the newspaper reports about. And they start off saying, well, what is that about? What is that all about? And they end up, by the end of this very long book, with a complete analysis of the total crisis of the British state in the 1970s. This book, there's a special edition of the IPPR journal about the kind of legacy of the magazine Marxism Today, which Stuart Hall went on to write for in the 80s. And they did some reviews of the books which were really influential on Marxism Today. And so then I was at the seminar at IPPR. I was there sat next to Charles Clark, opposite David Miliband. It was really high-powered. and the guy who'd done the review of Policing the Crisis, about 3 years ago, some PPE bod from the IPPR, was there, was talking to Will Davis about this review, and he said, it's a funny old book. Well, it starts off being about mugging, and then it ends up just being about sort of everything. I didn't know what to make of it. I thought... That's the entire point. That's what you want to know. What's wrong? What's wrong with the political class in Britain? So somebody faced with this analysis doesn't know what to make of it anymore. I mean, at least in the 80s, they thought they knew what to make of it. They thought, right, what we need to do is create new labour. But at least they had some notion of what the implications were. Now in terms of the history here, I think the thing to really get our heads around and the story that they tell in Policing the Crisis is that the so-called post-war consensus has broken down. Now, the post-war consensus is often cited as a sort of classic example of what in Gramscian terms is called a settlement, whereby there's a kind of uneasy alliance between competing social forces who more or less agree to a particular set of social conditions. And the argument very simply is that really from the New Deal onwards, you get the emergence of a model whereby industrial capital, the manufacturers, and the trade unions and governments sort of sort things out amongst themselves. They agree to a situation in which government does whatever is necessary to maintain high rates of employment and high productivity in manufacturing. The unions don't go communist and try and create a revolution, but they do get increasing wages, increasing standards of living, an increasing social wage, in other words, welfare benefits, and increasing capacity to consume, etc. I mean, incidentally, I haven't got a sort of Gramsci's own. Gramsci was the person, more than anyone, who saw this coming. His classic essay, Americanism and Fordism, written in the early 30s, is the thing which really predicted that what had started in Henry Ford's factories, the implementation of assembly lines, this very paternalist attitude on the part of a non-religious employer, the kind of very strictly gendered division of labour, there were no women working in the factory, men were expected to maintain this very kind of clean family image, was the sort of blueprint for an emerging new form of society, which is really what emerges in the 50s. And for various reasons, I mean, everybody's still arguing about why, really. I mean, this kind of settlement breaks down, this model breaks down, this model which from the 40s to the mid-70s largely makes possible expanded growth in the manufacturing centre, high rates of productivity, although they're declining from the early in the 60s, really. An increasing wage, and importantly, a shrinking gap between rich and poor starts to break down. I mean, it's this crucial phase in our history. I'm sure we all know this, but it's always worth reiterating this. I mean, to my knowledge, I'm not a sort of professional historian, to my knowledge, there are basically two periods that we know of when the gap between the rich and the poor significantly shrinks in Europe. There's the aftermath of the Black Death, when a third of the population dies, and so the value of labour goes right up. And there's the period from the 40s to the 70s. So it's a pretty significant achievement for the left. Anyway, this all starts to break down. It breaks down. We can argue about. I mean, my own argument is that it essentially breaks down because the first time in history, as a result of this success, for the first time in history in the 60s, you get a generation who come to maturity without any real fear about their immediate prospects, their fear of jobs, and so they start asking questions about why they should tolerate any form of exploitation whatsoever.
Can I just offer a counter
Yeah, please do.
Counter, but I mean, a Marxist political economy. Explanation would be a crisis of profitability. You know, like you've got, you know, there's this. I don't go in, but the tendency of the rate of profit to fall.
Sure.
Basically, after the Second World War, the argument is that it wasn't the Keynesian New Deal that really saved capitalism. It was the war which boosted demand, and then after the war, you've got this rebuilding of Europe. You've got the suburbanization of America. La la la. Huge. Possibilities of growth in consumer technologies, and then that reaches, you know, obviously that all of those, the welfareism that you talked about has costs, and as profitability begins to fall and labour asserts itself, it becomes a crisis of profitability, which reaches, and then there's obviously other global crises in the 70s, which reached the kind of nadir in the early 70s, and that sparks the counter-revolution, so that.
Well, that's exactly right, yeah. And I mean, what there isn't consensus on even amongst the Marxist economists is what actually causes the crisis of profitability, whether it's the endogenous logic of the tendency of the rate profit fall, whether it's, as Robert Brenner says, it's just inter-capitalist competition, or whether it's technological change. I mean, even the Marxist political economists don't fully agree about that. And I think one way or another, you know, whether it was just never going to be able to, given the level of demands, the escalation of demand, or whether it's been, or whether it's exacerbated, crucially, by declining profitability. What does happen? Two things do happen. Profitability declines at a time when the expectations of working people of lower wages, lower working hours, higher welfare spending, higher benefits are escalating, which I think means. It's interesting to reflect on this. I always say to students, this means the story told by the right. That the greedy unions were making the country the world ungovernable, making British industry unprofitable, was actually true. Now, you reach a point in the 70s where you just can't go on giving ever higher wages and ever higher public spending and still have capitalism. You know, you've got to make a choice. Either you're going to replace capitalism with something else, or you're going to have to bring down wages somehow. And So the capitalist class has to find a way to bring down wages. But how do you sell people a programme, which is what will become the neoliberal programme? How do you sell them a programme which is clearly going to affect most people badly? Well, the answer, according to Horne's colleagues, using a kind of Gramscian method, is what you do is, well, you tell them a story about what's happening. You tell them that the rise in unemployment, the general sense that things are breaking down, the general sense of insecurity is not caused by a crisis of profitability in capitalism and the incompatibility of their desires with the continuation of capitalism. It's caused by black people and hippies and trade unionists. And you kind of lump them all into this category. You say all these groups are threatening law and order, and what we're going to do is we're going to restore law and order. And so Thatcher gets elected, famously not saying she's going to privatise everything, not talking about selling off council houses. She does say she's going to smash the unions, and she says she's going to stop immigration and restore the traditional family. She does one of those things. She doesn't do much of the rest. You know, it's always worth keeping this in mind, that the first group of people to really get sold down the river by the neoliberals was the conservatives, the conservatives who vote, the social conservatives, the frightened kind of workers and petty bourgeois who voted for Thatcher, thinking she was going to take them back to the 50s. Which, to do that, she'd have had to restore the unions to the position they were in. But essentially what happens is that what is created by the press, by the right, is a new common sense, a new understanding of what's happening. That what's happening is a kind of general breakdown of law and order, which, you know, contests the left-wing common sense, which is that, you know, one version of the stories we were just throwing around is what's actually happening. And that this is the basis on which she gets elected. It's worth keeping in mind, and I think that even then, the analysts around things like Marxism Today, people like Stewart, didn't quite take enough account of this. That they never had to convince everyone of this story to get what they wanted. They only had to convince a really small section, actually, of the electorate and of the society to turn their backs on the labour movement and throw in their lots with Thatcherism, a strategically crucial section. But they only had to get a few people to do it. I mean, Thatcher only ever got 40-odd% of the vote. All right, I've said all this. Now, I think it's worth thinking, and this is where we start thinking about the nature of neoliberalism, though. It's worth thinking about what actually evolves then. So, I mean, it's really interesting to go back and read Policing the Crisis. I mean, some of it is just unreadable today. It's just, you know, it's really kind of dense. But what they see emerging is the philosophy of the new right. And the new right is this really weird combination of what we would still recognise today as neoliberalism, this kind of deep individualism in favour of competition, in favour of low taxes, in favour of anything that creates high profits, and social conservatism, a belief in the traditional family, in a kind of anti-feminism, a kind of coded racism, sometimes not very coded racism. Now, if you think about it for a minute, there's a clear contradiction between these things. I mean, neoliberalism says, deregulate. You do use the state, but you just use the state to make everyone into a competitive entrepreneur. You know, get everybody out there competing and working. I mean, you can't do that and defend the traditional family, which wasn't traditional. It'd only been in place for most people since the 30s and was based on the Fordist settlement, whereby, you know, the state maintains full employment so that men can command a high enough wage to look after a family without a woman having to work. Does this make sense? It doesn't make any sense at all. And some people on the right were saying this even at the time. I remember, I think it was Evelyn Waugh, were writing this kind of jokey column in the 80s saying, you know, the Conservatives haven't conserved anything. You know, so it was always a kind of weird, it was always quite a weird contradiction. By the 1990s, it was really sort of coming unstuck. And I think when Blair and Clinton, I mean, it was Clinton first really, came on the scene with something that kept the neoliberal economics, but linked it to a kind of individualistic social liberalism, then in some ways it was much more consistent. In some ways it was much more coherent, and it was much more sort of purely neoliberal. And so I think this is really the common sense which emerged in the 90s, and it's one which stresses the importance of individual achievement and self-expression above even traditional values, which tends to legitimate itself by presenting itself as the only way of being properly modern. So still my favourite example of this is Blair's famous Forces of Conservatism speech. He says probably his most important speech he ever gave. He said, what we are against is the forces of conservatism, by which we mean both the people on the right, both the old social conservatives and the people on the left. You've got this naive idea about collective provision and universal services. All right. So this is the bit where I thought we'd say something about neoliberalism. All right. So, I think it's worth keeping in mind about neoliberalism. It's a term which kind of refers to a number of sort of related things. So on the one hand, it's sort of, it's just the name for a tradition of social philosophy, which goes back to the 30s. On the other hand, it's the name for an actual political project. It's the name for a general programme, a set of government policies. Arguably, it's the name for an ideology. Now, why I think it's important to make this distinction is because, I think the relationship between what you might call theoretical neoliberalism and sort of actually existing neoliberalism is quite complicated. That on the one hand, there's this tradition of... this is kind of what everybody understands by neoliberalism. And this is just quickly for the benefit of anybody who isn't sort of confident about the term. It's a philosophy that stresses the value of individual competition, private enterprise as the main engine of economic and social creativity, thinks that market mechanisms are the best means to allocate resources. It leads to a set of policies we're all familiar with, privatising public access, cutting taxes, restricting trade union activities, deregulating labour markets, etc. Now, as I've said already, it can be articulated to a range of... That programme can be articulated to a range of different social policies. I mean, my own perception was this is one of the things that really confused people about Blair, for example, in the early 90s. I think, because people, after the experience of the 80s, when neoliberal economics had only been linked to very socially conservative economic programmes, people thought that essentially if you were pro-gay rights, if you were pro-gay marriage, you couldn't be a neoliberal. It didn't really make any sense. I remember Stewart famously saying, well, Tony Blair looked like someone who'd have a gay person to dinner, so he might be all right. And I think this is what really sort of confused people. I think really one of the things that's really shaken a lot of the sort of assumptions and understandings of the left broadly since the 1990s, actually, has been the fact that we've seen a form of capitalism emerge, which is very clearly capitalistic and can be intended to be so, but it isn't kind of associated with these traditional trappings of social conservatism. But I think, as I was saying, there's a kind of difference between, liberalism and neoliberalism. Well, this is a really important point, and this is a sort of crucial analytical point that, in terms of understanding what neoliberalism, both as a philosophy, going back to the kind of writings of people like Hayek, etc., in the 30s and 40s, and as an enacted programme involves. And this is really, really crucial, I think. But classical liberalism thinks that human beings are naturally competitive, individualistic, and entrepreneurial. I know you two have heard me say this before, not everybody has. And that's what gives rise to this kind of the agenda of of laissez-faire, the idea that government should just get out of people's lives, leave them alone, and they'll just get on with creating value. Now, neoliberalism, crucially, it's Foucault who is the first person to really identify this difference in the 70s. Neoliberalism is born out of the kind of thinking of a bunch of people who see themselves as inheriting that liberal tradition, but they're in the 1930s, they're in the middle of the rise of fascism and communism and socialism and social democracy. There's collectivism going on all over the place. And to put it crudely, the conclusion they draw is that although the liberal tradition is right, that everything would work better if everybody thought of themselves as an entrepreneur, a competitor, a commercial operator. People can't be expected naturally to do that. You can't just trust people to go on and get on with it. So actually what you want is a government which encourages or even forces people to behave that way, whether they want to or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So the ordo-liberals, is that where much of that came from?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the ordo-liberals is the German group who formed, the German-Austrian group that formulated a lot of that. And neoliberal is really kind of American term for it. But they are all sort of part of the same networks because they all, I mean, they, it all begins with this, I mean, in fact, they start using the terms at the same time, actually, ordo-liberal and neoliberal. They all start just before the 40s. This famously starts as the colloque Walter Lippmann sort of seminar in 38. They go, you know, the most influential member of that is Hayek. Hayek goes on to form the Mont Pelerin Society, the thing Compass still dreams of becoming for the left. Hayek had published, you know, in 44 he publishes The Road to Serfdom, which eventually becomes Thatcher's Bible. So maybe it's 40 years till Common Ground is carried around by a prime minister. And they have this kind of very intensive network of right-wing intellectuals, journalists, politicians, think tanks, and spreading their ideas. Now, this is where, I mean, there's a kind of historical debate here as to how successful that is. And I think there's one version of this story which says this network of right-wing intellectuals were so incredibly successful, were such brilliant operators, that they made neoliberalism happen. And from my point of view, that's not a sufficiently sort of Gramscian or a sufficiently Marxist explanation, because I think there was loads of networks of intellectuals with mental ideas knocking about who would have liked to form governments, etc. But really throughout the 50s and 60s, they didn't really have much success. I mean, Enoch Powell was a big fan. There were kind of people on the lunatic fringe of the right. But broadly speaking, these people were considered nutters. I mean, Hayek was definitely more out on a limb in the 50s and 60s than someone like, you know, me or Neil is now. I mean, he wasn't getting anywhere near, you know, MPs' offices or the mainstream of political parties. He was right out there. That's not to say that kind of network of intellectuals is, you know, it is not to say there isn't a lesson for us on the left there. But if they hadn't had that dense network and that very kind of international and well-established network of think tanks, of university departments, of books, of ideas, of seminars, if they hadn't had all that, then once they hadn't been building it for 40 years, then once their historic opportunity came, well, they wouldn't have been able to take advantage of it. And their historic opportunity certainly did come. It really comes in the early 70s, at the moment of this crisis we're talking about. It doesn't start, it isn't, and the first place it is implemented isn't Britain, it's implemented in Chile. This really crucial moment in world history, I think. Again, many of you will know this history better than I do, but some of you won't know it at all, so I'm going to bang on about it. President Allende, arguably the first avowed Marxist to be elected the head of a Latin American government in free elections. I mean, it wasn't the result of a coup. He was elected. Chile, big, rich, strategically crucial part of Latin America. Really interesting. There's been some interesting stuff published on this recently. Chile, you think about how important the cybernetic revolution has been to this whole history, and we're not going to talk about it today. Chilean government is already experimenting with the help of a British cybernetic theorist and kind of early computer engineer, a computer network in 1970, which they are hoping is going to assist in national economic planning and decision making. This is their answer to the question: how is socialist planning really going to work? How are we going to have a democratic capitalist economy? We're going to use this new technology, the computers, to make that possible. And computer technology, we're going to make it possible. Well, the American government wasn't having any of that. In 1973, CIA backs and largely instigates a military coup against Allende, installs Pinochet. You remember Thatcher, still thought of as a hero till his death. And they send over Hayek's students from Chicago to sort out the economy in Chile. This is a really good picture. This is Hayek and Milton. This is Milton Friedman. I don't think Hayek's there. It's Milton Friedman and someone else sitting with sitting with Pinochet. Milton Friedman was to go on to become Thatcher's kind of economic guru. Pinochet's regime lasts until 1990. He's now widely recognised as the first neoliberal government. It did promote economic growth, but we all know on what terms.
Chair, can I just ask a question?
Yeah, please.
You said the US sent over Friedman and all of those people. The US government at that time wanted to install a neoliberal
Yeah.
Project. It was what, Carter at that time?
Well, no, that would have been Ford, or Nixon and Ford. I mean, when you say the government, it would have been really the security agencies kind of involved. And the security agencies like the CIA, who had a really strong networks connected to the universities, especially kind of right-wing universities like Chicago. I mean, to what extent they... I mean, sure, they didn't really need to send them. I mean, it's probably a bit of a hyperbole to say they sent them. It's, you know, they...
The government
did
pay
them to go.
Yeah.
All right, so it wasn't hyperbole. Yeah. Thank you. That's why we're all here. All right. So, yeah, they sent over these people who, at the time, even in mainstream academic economics at this time, would be considered absolutely the lunatic fringe. So complete nutters. You know, it would be like us sending him. It would be like us sending James to like sort out someone's economy. Sorry. Okay. So a comment about sort of neoliberalism generally that I would say around the world neoliberalism makes progress on various fronts. I'm not expecting everybody to read all this. David Harvey, in his book on neoliberalism, cites the 75 budget crisis in New York as a key moment. Other histories cite the taxpayers' revolts in California. There's one really interesting development, though, which starts to make the concept of neoliberalism a bit more open and a bit sort of baggier, and that's the adoption of effectively neoliberal program in China from the early 1980s onwards. From the early 80s onwards, the Chinese Communist Party adopts as its official policy a program of privatization, of rolling back welfare, of disrupting unions, etc. Now, I've lost count of the number of people I asked, people who read Chinese, people who studied in China, people who know the kind of history of the Chinese Communist Party. Is there any evidence that the Chinese Communist officials had ever even heard of Hayek? Nobody's been able to give me a straight answer. Nobody's sure, but there doesn't seem to be any evidence that they'd even heard of Hayek and Friedman. Clearly, they were copying the policies being enacted by Western and Latin American governments. But the point here is that neoliberalism, what I call actually existing neoliberalism, as a kind of program, has a kind of tenuous relationship to the tradition of Hayek, etc. That it gets taken up to the extent that it serves the interest of powerful groups. It gets taken up to the extent that it serves the project of capital accumulation, etc.
It's difficult to see when you tell the story how it isn't just some kind of brilliant conspiracy by a small group of elites that knew the exact people in the financial institutions that they had to speak to, and but rather than there being an organic element to it as well.
Okay, well, I can fill that in for you if you want. If you look at what elites are actually saying to each other, especially in the early 70s, at the peak of the kind of social crisis caused by the rise of the social movement in the 60s, the rise of political demands, they're absolutely panicking, and they don't know what to do about it. There's this famous document written by Samuel Huntington and some French guy and some Japanese guy, the report of the Trilateral Commission, in which says that Western democracies are becoming ungovernable, because in the literal term they use is the excess of democracy. At the same time, you look at what's happening. This is a story told in Policing the Crisis. It's also a story told in relation to France by people like Boltanski and Cipello. In the very early 70s, Edward Heath's government here, Nixon's government in America, right, governments in places like France, they're sort of aware of these ideas, and they have discussions. Should we go for this? Start privatising stuff, and they panic. They say, no, we can't get away with that. And in fact, Nixon and Heath, for example, spend more money on public sector. Their governments spend more on public services and more on trying to shore up the wage and the social wage than any other government in history. This makes sense? So it's quite clear through the 70s, elites are panicking and are scrabbling around for something, for a solution, for something to do. And it's only once the new right emerges with this weird synthesis of neoliberal economics and a kind of right-wing social agenda, and manages to win some elections, the elites start buying into it properly. Does that make sense?
I think the other thing that was going on was that the left had run out of steam. That they found themselves on the left defending the status quo, which was clearly disintegrating, and simply saying, we need more of it. We need more public spending. We need higher wages, whatever. And so, I mean, my remembrance of that time is of just a deepening sense of disintegration and chaos on the left. And you know, in the end, you found yourself confronted with thinking, well, is it Thatcher, or is it an alternative economic strategy which involves withdrawing from Europe and imposing, you know, import controls and kind of autarky? It's crazy. There's no choice at all. So I think you know, that part of the issue about how you achieve hegemony is about not just about who wins, but how people lose. Because the losing is a very important part of the winning.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, I couldn't put any better.
And also, I mean, it's all being expressed in, like, real, you know, with many economic expressions of it, but inflation, obviously, is a really, really central issue. And that is bound up with wage demands, and, you know, and so these guys come with a very coherent and simple narrative for dealing with, and effective in a very brutal way, for dealing with inflation. And so it's, I guess, music to policymakers, economic policymakers' ears in that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, I think. And I would say, in economic terms, it's true, the left didn't, you know, I mean, I think you had got to a point, you're either going to abolish capitalism or you're going to have to do it completely different. There wasn't, capitalism on those terms wasn't sustainable. So, and nobody was really putting on the agenda, let's abolish capitalism.
And actually, I mean, the left, you know, the kind of trade union, the labour movement, actually spoke for a minority of the population. I mean,
yeah,
you know, when you have inflation running at 25% annually, if you have, if you're in a trade union that can achieve a wage settlement, you were fine. If you were someone who was retired, living on savings, you were destroyed.
No, that's a really good
point. And the Labour movement had nothing to say to those.
No, that's a really good point, and that's one of the reasons I think I'm right. Why? That's why Gramsci starts to get taken up by some of the most forward-thinking sections.
Because those people
left,
said,
because
it's the Tories, you know.
Yeah, and because the left didn't recognise the need to try to put together a social coalition that was bigger than its own traditional base, and this was. And it took a very long time for it to realise that. It took a very long time.
Still hasn't.
No, you're right. It still hasn't. But lots of stuff that people like Stuart and his colleagues were saying in the 70s, you know, people were still, you know, I mean, I remember in the 80s, my earliest memories, I remember I was on demos in the 70s as a little kid, but Arthur demanding more public sector wages, which pushing up inflation.
Marxism.
Yeah, in the 80s, was it, you know, essentially that was still the case. In the 80s, most of the left thought that you could go back to social democracy of the 50s, 60s and 70s. And if you said you couldn't, if you said, look, the global economy is changing in such a way that's impossible, you were just called a class traitor. And you were just...
Or if you actually said, you know, it wasn't that great. You know,
no, exactly.
There are a lot of people that it didn't include that were
well, that's
in the
right.
labour movement.
And of course, you know, I mean, from our point of view, the new left had had that critique from the early 60s. I mean, the new left, Raymond Williams was saying from the early 60s, the new left student movement in the States was saying from the early 60s, the welfare state is too bureaucratic, the union, they were saying the unions don't represent everybody, they only represent, kind of, you know, they represent the white, skilled, manual working class and who have a kind of hegemony which isn't great for everybody. So I think that's a really good point, and it really does, and it also points to some of the problems, actually, which applying kind of Gramscian theory, if you like, to an increasingly diverse and complex society generates, because it becomes increasingly difficult to understand, well, how do you put together these coalitions? What does it even mean to put together a social coalition of that nature? Well, I've talked about all this. All right, so now we're going to sort of come. I want us to talk more about sort of common sense and have some and lead into discussions about the implications of it for our own political strategies. Then, because as I said, propagating sympathetic common sense isn't the only way for hegemonic groups to secure consent. And often, one of the key points is that real concessions have to be made to the demands of what Gramsci calls the subaltern groups. And I think. This is my sort of general sketch.
Can you describe that term you just used?
Sorry, subaltern.
Yeah.
Subaltern just means not hegemonic. That's all it means. It's like a military, quasi-military term, but it's just, that's all it means. So consent, and I would say consent for neoliberalism in countries like the UK, we've talked about this a bit already. First and foremost, majority populations have been offered the opportunity to participate in certain forms of consumption on a massive scale. Now, this is quite different from the way in which people were recruited into the belief in post-war social democracy, for example. Well, people were offered an improved standard of living, but there was this sense of a collective project and social fairness. It's quite different. And I think I think you can understand a lot of what goes on in contemporary politics and culture if we understand that. They have to keep giving us opportunities to consume. So, for example, you know, the massive inflation and seemingly never-ending inflation of personal debt is crucial here, because this is how they get us to go along with it, for the most part. They get us to go along with it by giving us opportunities to spend. And they don't want to pay us wages to enable us to spend, so you have to expand debt. Key groups, managers, media professionals, politicians have been persuaded. Now, we can argue about this. We'd like to know what people think about this, because this is just, I don't have any studies to support this. I just have my own anecdotal experience, really. The political class, if you like, in the broadest sense, have basically been sold on neoliberalism. They've been convinced it's the only way you can do things. The rest of us haven't, really, I think. The rest of us just recognise the political classes. I mean, you look at Britain today, we're all standing around watching a Labour leadership election in which no one is saying what most people in Britain think. You know, they're all just mouthing a set of neoliberal platitudes. You know, there's no better manifestation of neoliberal common sense than the fact that every Labour leadership candidate is speaking to the same script. But it's a common sense which I think our relationship to it's not the same as in the 50s, when sort of there was this notion that there was a broad social consensus. It's this sort of, it has this kind of weird status that we all recognise we have to defer to it, but we don't really believe in it, which is quite complicated. I think it is really important, I think, to keep in mind that since the 60s, and this is one of the crucial things neoliberalism has offered, is young people, and especially women, have benefited, at least women in the professional classes in particular, have benefited from a radical liberalisation of social values. I mean, you know, the way in which we can live our lives, the kind of multiplicity of lifestyles which is tolerated, is really different, I think. But it's social groups who've had the least chance of benefiting from the massive rise in consumption, the least chance of becoming managers, and those who see the least immediate benefit from social liberalisation have been largely ignored. And in global terms, those are the groups and those are the terms on which, those groups from which, and those are the terms on which real resistance to neoliberalism has largely come. I mean, in global terms, you know, what is the main source of opposition to neoliberal hegemony globally? I mean, outside Latin America, it's forms of politicised religion, which largely have their bases amongst those social groups which haven't been given the chance to participate in globalised, kind of Americanised consumption, and who either reject or don't feel they can benefit from social liberalisation. Does that make sense? I think this is... you know, and I think that's a sort of crucial element of this. All right, so we've talked about this a bit. Okay, so this is where we. I'm kind of getting to the end of me just kind of pontificating points. So hopefully we can sort of talk about this stuff a bit. I think it's really important to keep in mind that common sense, even as Gramsci understands it, is not just about the conscious assumptions that people hold in their head. It's also about the everyday routines and habits that we live through, which can be seen themselves to embody certain sets of assumptions, even if they're not consciously adhered to. I'll give you some example of what I mean. Actually, before I say any of that, there's another point I wanted to make, which is around one reason why the notion of hegemony as a kind of complex idea is quite powerful, is because it does take account of the fact that very broadly speaking, power relationships can often be maintained without any particular interventions in what people think about the world. There's a really interesting book on this subject published around 1980 by a couple of British sociologists called Abercrombie and Hill. And it's called The Dominant Ideology Thesis. By the dominant ideology thesis, it means the general thesis, which I think most people here have kind of voiced some sympathy with, which kind of people like myself and Alan have made our careers mostly explaining to students, the idea that within a particular society there are a governing set of ideas which maintain existing power. And they don't say that doesn't happen. I mean, actually, they have their specific idea is actually the function of common sense, for example, is mostly to maintain unity amongst the ruling class. It's mostly the way they talk to each other and themselves about it. Now, this is my summary of their thesis. This is my little sort of bon mot, but their thesis is you don't need a dominant ideology in a situation in which the material conditions mitigate against any kind of serious collective struggle to change social relations. Now, put this very crudely, in a society where, keeping in mind that, you know, it's still statistically the case that the overwhelming majority of adults, their main preoccupation will be feeding their children for most of their adult life. In a society where feeding your children is difficult but possible, that is where you will dedicate your energies, rather than making revolution. If it becomes impossible, you might have to make revolution. If it becomes too easy, which I think is basically what happened in the 60s, you might make revolution. But as long as it remains difficult but possible, you won't. So as long as you have a situation like we have in Britain today, where there's relatively low unemployment, but there's a general sense of insecurity in the workplace, there's a general sense that you have to work very hard, very long, until an old age in order to keep your children able to consume and keep them alive, you don't really need people to think it's a good system, because people will be preoccupied with keeping their children alive and fed. Does that make sense? So that's one element of the approach. So I think it's important to understand that hegemony is maintained not just through propagating common sense, not just through getting people to think particular ways or make particular sense. It's also through delimiting the ways in which people are able to act in sort of material ways. Now, even at the level of common sense, as I said, common sense is not just about ideas, it's also about habits. It's about how we think, and it's about forms of behaviour which are not necessarily to do with to do with the content of our ideas. So I said I'd give an example of this. The example that I always give to my students is that my big kind of intellectual project is a radical critique of individualism, radical critique of competitive individualism in its neoliberal and even its pre-neoliberal forms. The way in which competitive individualism manifests itself in the education system historically is more than anything through the practice of competitive grading, the practice of marking, the idea that at the end point of the educational process, what happens is everybody gets a number and you see who gets the best number. It's not a mad idea of mine, this is stupid. In America, there's a big tradition of the radical liberal arts colleges not giving grades. I mean, UC Santa Cruz until quite recently didn't give grades because it's just considered a stupid thing to do. You can write someone a reference, you can write about what kind of a student this person was. And I always say to students, to me, I'm really good at marking, I can do it really quickly, I know exactly what the internationally agreed standard of a particular piece of student work is going to be, no one ever argues with it, the external examiner's always very impressed, but I think it's a totally stupid thing to do. It's a complete idiotic way of concluding 3 years of studies. You know, you just go away on your own and write something, and then you get a number for it. And I always say to my students, well, really, I think it would be much better if instead of doing that, we all went away for a weekend, you all read each other's essays, we all had a conversation about it, you'd learn more in that weekend, you'd double your learning over the past 3 years. That'd be much better. And we should just refuse to do grades. And they say, yeah, that's a good idea. I say, but what's going to happen if we do that? I'm going to get sacked. You lot are not going to have the bit of paper with the number on to take out into the labour market. And that is how ideology really works. It works through constraining behaviour. And now, this is really kind of out there in Foucault, I'm giving you now more than Gramsci. And this, what is the consequences of this? What are the political implications of all that? Is that when we're thinking about political struggle, we're thinking about progressive strategies, we're thinking about policy, we have to think about the kind of material conditions of people's experience, and not just about sort of making arguments for them, I think. Okay. So now we're moving on thinking more broadly about what are the implications of all this for sort of political strategy, for sort of political activity, for political action. I would say the key thing, it sounds really obvious, it sounds really basic, but the Gramsci's basic claim about how you do politics successfully is you try to persuade people who don't already agree with you to agree with you. That's the first thing. It sounds really obvious, but in my experience, a large numbers of people, at least on the kind of various sections of the left, don't get that. They don't think that's the thing you have to do. They think the thing you have to do is, you know, tell the world you're here, you know, make your claim, assert your identity, you know, define your position. The idea that it doesn't really, the Gramscian position, which might not always be right, but the basic Gramscian position, is none. It doesn't matter how right you are. if no one is listening to you. It doesn't matter how right you are if you can't persuade people who didn't agree with you yesterday already to agree with you, already to agree with you. So I'm going to think of, I think of two examples in kind of recent, of sort of, I'll say a bit about them later. Two examples of kind of recent, relatively recent political projects that I kind of at least attended or supported, but wasn't really involved with organising, which did and didn't come from that perspective. One which absolutely didn't really sort of take account of, or maybe it was necessary, didn't take account of the perspective, was Climate Camp. Do you remember Climate Camp? Climate Camp was a lot of fun, but I was always, I'm convinced to this day, there isn't one person on the planet who changed their mind about climate change because Climate Camp was there. And nobody said, oh, there's a bunch of people camping in a field near Heathrow. I reckon that climate change thing is really important. On the other hand, the counter example is something like UK Uncut. UK Uncut was very... Do you all know about UK Uncut? UK Uncut sort of was a... If people weren't here, went in the country, UK Uncut was a project put together by people, some of whom had been around things like Climate Camp, and the idea was to change through kind of peaceful direct action with some kind of spectacular consequences, get some media attention, was to change the kind of media narrative around austerity, to at least challenge the idea that cuts were necessary, to point out the, in particular, the extent of corporate non-taxpayer. And there were limitations, but they had some real success. They had some real success. And I remember thinking, this is really exciting, because Polly Toynbee, was going on some of those demonstrations and supporting it. Somebody who hadn't been part of that kind of historic militant activist milieu was sympathetic to this cause and was putting it together. I mean, the way I often kind of summarise this is, for me, the kind of the lesson of history, the way in which actual reforms get won, and this is a kind of Gramscian point of view, I think, is that you have to be realistic and pragmatic in setting achievable objectives, and you have to be absolutely militant in your determination to achieve them. And it sounds really simple, but it's quite difficult to achieve, because usually the kind of person who wants to be militant wants to demand the world tomorrow, and the kind of person who wants to be pragmatic doesn't really want to fight for it. So, and Gramsci, I think, does give us a way of thinking outside of that contradiction. So Gramsci uses this fantastic phrase, I think it's still really useful, he thinks that, which I think is still really relevant today. He says, in modern society, politics is a war of position, a kind of trench warfare, where there's very rarely absolute winners and losers. There's a constant struggle to win ground from our opponents. And the war of position, the reason this got taken up so much, for example, in cultural studies, is the war of position doesn't just involve arguments over economics. It involves a kind of culture war as well. It involves involves developing your own media. It involves involves trying to get a different set of ideas to those represented in your enemy's common sense into sort of popular culture, for example. Does this make sense? So, for example, if you wanted to contest neoliberal common sense, you need, from this point of view, you don't just need a better economic programme. You need to be looking for things that are going on in the broader culture, which are not informed by a kind of logic of competitive individualism. It's why, people of my sort of cohort got excited about rave in the early 90s. It seemed about kind of an active celebration of communality, kind of collective culture. And it was this kind of self-conscious refusal of Thatcherite individualism. Didn't really get us anywhere, but...
Good time, though.
Sorry?
You had a good time.
I had a good time, yeah. And similarly, it means, for example, that what goes on in schools is really important. I remember I met Michael Gove at a seminar in about 1995. He came to this seminar I'd helped organise and told us all there was not going to be a Tory meltdown in 1997. You got that wrong, in case you didn't know. But his tone was really grand. I remember I said to him in the afternoon, that was basically a Gramscian analysis. And he sort of laughed. And he cited Gramsci about education recently. Gove really gets that for the right, you've got to capture this crucial kind of cultural and social terrain. This is why he's making... he tried to make yet another assault on the schools. It's really interesting thinking about neoliberalism in schools, because neoliberalism has had to be imposed through a series of really severe mechanisms, the SAT, the league tables, etc. And it's perpetually frustrating to the right that they cannot recruit the teaching profession to their project. They just won't have it. The teaching profession to this day is its basic, its normative professional common sense is still heavily influenced by a kind of progressive education of the 60s and 70s. So they have to bring in these punitive mechanisms to just force teachers to do what they want them to do. Because they know, you just, if you're a Tory and a neoliberal, you just don't become a teacher. Why would you bother? You go and do something to make some money. And now that's the war of position being fought. That is the war of position being fought. And that is what, you know, that is, from this point of view, this is part of what's required. Okay, now, so we've got, finally, you know, before we can have a sort of final discussion about, you know, strategy and opposition, I'll get into some of the more kind of, some of the slightly more complicated conceptual issues that come out of all this stuff. There's a bit of an issue in Gramsci, there's a bit of an issue in all this stuff I've been talking to you about, in that it's not entirely, I've talked about the struggle for hegemony, I've talked about social groups struggling for hegemony. It's not entirely sure, clear a lot of the time, who they, what kind of groups they are. Because Gramsci is classically coming from a kind of Marxist perspective, where history is ultimately about the clash between the bourgeois and the proletarians. But most of the time he's not talking about bourgeois and proletarians, he's talking about these much smaller groups, what you call sometimes class fractions. So, for example, the hegemonic class fraction of the in the post-war settlement isn't really, you know, the hegemonic group, the group that seems to be running things, is a sort of combination of the manufacturers, industrial capital, and the union leaderships. But that's certainly how people perceived it at the time. It's always really extraordinary to hear recordings of things like Question Time from the 50s and 60s, including the 50s when the Tories were in government through the whole decade. People from the right were incredibly bleak about their prospects. They thought this, that, I mean, a lot of people on the right thought that the triumph of socialism was inevitable. The unions had just taken over and they were going to get stronger and stronger. So what you've got there is, and that's also the period during which industrial capital is the leading section of the capitalist class. I mean, Gramsci and others make a kind of crude distinction between industrial capital, the manufacturers, and finance capital, the people who lend them the money to manufacture stuff. And I always say that, you know, it's interesting to think about how do we think about bankers and speculators and finance capitalists. Since the 80s, we think of them as scary or sexy, but they're kind of, they're important. You look at the late 19th century, the literature of the late 19th century, financiers, speculators, they're the kind of buccaneering, you know, heroes of metropolitan capitalism. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, a stockbroker is a guy in a pinstripe suit who's like a metaphor for boringness and tediousness.
With a lunchbox.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now that is the period when finance capital was constrained and contained by government regulation, by an economic program which privileged manufacturing, etc. That is the reality of the situation. So during that period, Gramsci has a name for these kind of coalitions of class fractions. He calls it historic bloc. The historic bloc is his name for, say, the alliance between the trade union or the manufacturing unions and the manufacturers, which effectively becomes hegemonic in the post-war period. I think it's worth thinking about today. Well, is there a hegemonic bloc in Britain or globally today? Is there a historic bloc which is hegemonic? Is there a particular... I mean, I've suggested the bankers would be at least part of it. But, I mean, what do you... I mean, this is an open question. It's not a kind of lead... I don't have a right answer scribbled on my arm that you've got to get... I mean, who are the groups who sort of shape and determine social outcomes, our lives, our perceptions?
Media.
I think media clearly is crucial.
Marketing.
Media, marketing.
Big tech.
Big tech. You know,
I'm just playing about what you've said.
No, you're getting ahead of me now. You're getting ahead of me now. I mean, my own thesis is that for the first time we've actually got sort of, he knows this. We've got sort of global historic bloc, and it's the banks and big tech. It's Google more and Apple more than anyone. I always say, if you think about the culture wars since the 60s, who really got the world they wanted? It wasn't the conservatives, as we said. It wasn't the radicals. We didn't really get the world we wanted. The one person who got exactly the world he wanted is Steve Jobs. You know, this is exactly the world he wanted to live in, you know, in every respect. The combination of social liberalism, of capital running rampant, of everybody's on iPhones, but we're listening to the same music we were listening to 20 years ago, because he doesn't care if it's any different, as long as we're downloading it from him. I mean, he's dead now, but you get the point. But I think you're right. I mean, there is. I think you're right. If there is a historic block, you're right. I think it's on the national scale. I think it's, you know, it's the banks, the media class, the political class, marketing. That reference to marketing is really important because marketing, the notion that marketing is the way you get power, the way you do things, is part of the class common sense or of that historic block. I think of that. It's the part of their shared common sense, and it is part of what disseminates out into the wider society. And it's one reason why, you know, I was having a row with Alan Finneyson about Neon, for example, and he said, "Are they too fixated on things like marketing?" And I said, "Well, they're having me do a seminar. Let me do a seminar in the basement about Gramsci. What do you want?" But his point was that his kind of argument is there, which is quite worth taking seriously, is that even in large sections of the left, to the extent that we think, well, how you do politics is, oh, you get a snappy slogan that sells your product and you make it go viral, is arguably a sign that we have adopted that common sense to some extent. That is a problem with it. Now, there's a bit of a problem there, because then if you say you don't do anything the way your enemies do it, then you don't learn anything from them. But it is a really powerful argument. I'll say a little bit about Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe. Laclau has had a bit of coverage. Ernesto died last year. And he's seen as being kind of influenced on things like Podemos, etc. Broadly speaking, Laclau and Mouffe offer a reading of Gramsci and a theory of hegemony which goes further in saying, well, it's not necessarily social classes that enter into struggles for hegemony and context. They actually, it can be... Now, it becomes a bit not that clear what it is. I'm saying this, I wasn't an essay student, but I did my PhD about his work. He was my external examiner. He was really important to me in kind of encouraging me as an academic, as a theorist. So, but there is, you know, it's a bit not clear. So at one point in their work, it seems to be that it's sort of discourses that enter into struggle. So it's neoliberalism is contesting, like, post-Fordism, I don't know what it is. It's contesting conservatism. And it's quite vague, actually, what actually goes into it. Now, to some extent, that is useful. It's a useful way of thinking about things sometimes, that you don't have to just think in terms of concrete social groups, but you can think of particular complexes of ideas as entering into struggle with each other for hegemony. So, for example, you can say that sort of consumerism, which is really related to this notion of marketing, as a way of relating to the world, operates in a kind of discursive way across different social groups. And that you could say it's contested by various other discourses like ecology. I think that's a good ecology is a good example, because ecology is clearly a political practice, a programme, a set of ideas, which doesn't have one clear class basis. It's not clearly rooted in one social group. And it is a set of ideas which are contesting ideas like consumerism, by which I mean the idea that, you know, you should relate to everything in the world like a consumer. Now, the way they see these kind of these conflicts between discourses happening is through this process of what they call articulation, what they mean connection or linkage. And this is sort of, this is basically their analogous extrapolation of the old idea that hegemony is about putting together coalitions. So rather than just coalitions of social groups or even rainbow coalitions of social movements, they see the kind of abstract logic is that you create these different, these kind of connections between sets of ideas. And they see that really politics end up being the struggle over the meaning of these key, what they call nodal signifiers. A signifier just meaning a word or a term, a nodal one being one that's central to a network, and over what they call empty signifiers, which don't really mean anything, but they become very important in defining a whole field. So a classic example for us maybe would be, and this is something that Alan Finneyson and myself have written about before, and something, you know, other people here have written about, the notion of modernity, the notion of the modern. So the modern just ends up being something we're all supposed to be definitely in favour of, and we're all arguing over, well, what does it actually mean? And Blair, you know, Blair says it doesn't really matter what I'm for, I'm just modern.
Jeremy, sorry to interrupt. You asked us not to be passive. Yeah. I'm sort of conscious we've got 20 minutes left.
All right, fine, good, good.
Really interesting people. And I think like your analysis has been really helpful, but I have just been for myself, I'd quite like to talk
great
to some other people.
Yeah, yeah, do, do. Okay, how do you how do we want to organise that?
I mean, personally, I'd be happy sort of just, there seems probably enough, like five or six people, but like if we'd have a...
All right, you're happy to do that?
Because I mean, I'm only speaking for myself.
No, I'm really happy.
Because you invited that.
No, I'm really happy for that to happen. I was really, at the start, I was thinking that I wouldn't get people to talk in groups. It's something that people do with students and it seems patronising. But if you think it's going to work...
I also talk to my friends in groups.
Yeah, No, I'm really happy. That's a really good idea. Are we happy to do that?
Well, I'm only speaking for myself.
In my own, passion and work, I come from, Greenwich is a big inspiration, but one thing missing here for me, I mean, I agree with pretty much everything, but it's that bit where Gramsci says the fundamental hegemonic relationship is pedagogical, and that all men, he says men, but let's all human beings are intellectuals, and so for me, I take that and then I go into this idea of everybody's an intellectual, and that the historical subject, if we want to change history, we've got to be intellectuals. You're an intellectual. That potential, and therefore the revolution is pedagogical, and the revolution is dialogical. It's got to be dialogical. It's got to. And so I'm with you. I think it's been absolutely brilliant analysis. But
well, let's do
there's
it.
So much brilliant people here, I'm sure.
Well, let's do it. No, I completely agree. I completely agree. Let's do it. Let's do it. Okay. So how do you want to do it? Do you want to?
Shall we stick to the tables?
Stick to the tables. Yeah. Should we talk for 10 minutes or 5 minutes and come back with some questions or some things you've come up with that everyone else can hear? Do you want to do it that way?
Talk for 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
Right. 10
all right.
Minutes. Yeah, mine's too
all right, fine.
Okay.
Great. I was just getting to it. I didn't know anything about it.